Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Return on Intelligence podcast. I'm your host, Rich Fernandez. I'm the CEO of SOI Global. We're an emotional intelligence training and development company. And I am so thrilled today to welcome a fellow practitioner, an industry thought leader, and that's Laura Overton. So Laura, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Likewise. Just so for the audience, though, let me tell them a little bit about you briefly, and then we can get into it. So Laura is an experienced international speaker, author, and facilitator in the learning and development space. Laura has been tracking the L&D innovation journey for the last two decades and has authored or co-authored over 70 major research reports and is a regular contributor to industry publications and has written over 300 articles. Her career spans international marketing, customer success, training and development, e-learning, and more. And so it's really exciting because Laura brings tremendous insights and research about the L&D space, not just in terms of effective practices, but also in terms of next practices. So I am so excited that you could join us today and share some of those insights. And again, welcome.
I'm looking forward to hearing your insights as well, Rich. I'm loving your podcast, so it's a real honor to be here.
Okay, thank you so much. Yeah, I'm looking forward to this being a conversation, and that's really what we aim for. So let's dive into it. First of all, Laura, I mean, I gave that brief bio, but I'd love if you could share a little bit about your own career evolution in the learning and development space for our audience.
Yes, the bio sounds like I spend my whole life writing. That has not been the case. and in fact, actually, I think I'm one of those rare people, Rich, who's joined the learning profession straight from university. I was hooked on the way that we learn things, and I was hooked on the idea that you could be in a career that could bring out the potential in other people. And so from a very early age, clearly a small child, I joined the learning profession. But and it was actually in the mid-80s, and I saw for the first time some technology that was kept in the learning center in a cupboard under the stairs. It was a massive interactive video disc that taught you how to be a versatile leader in a versatile organization. And in fact, a lot of the things that you're talking about, you know, how we connect, how we engage, you know, are kind of a like in the mid-80s, and they were using this interactive technology. I was so sold on this that I then got involved in the technology-enabled learning industry from a very, very early stage. And the first 15 years of my career was working with new innovation and new ideas in technology and trying to bring those to life in new organizations. So it was an amazingly incredible time through the birth of the internet, through the birth of the CD-ROM, you know. I'm really aging myself here, so I'll move on quickly. But the idea for me was that I was involved working with organizations who were doing things with technology for the first time. So I'm not a technologist, but I'm really passionate about why some organizations connect and engage with new tools and new way of doing things and others don't. And in my career, first 15 years, I saw some incredible impact back into business, you know, shifts in being able to roll out new skills, new competencies, you know, really making a difference. But I was a woman in a very male-oriented career, I have to confess. And so therefore, a lot of the conversations that I had, I was drawing on every ounce of innovative thinking in order to have new conversations. And I really drew on research, Rich. I know that your organization, you really connect with evidence-informed strategies behind what you're doing. And it was something for me throughout the 90s was absolutely critical. What was the independent evidence saying about new ways of doing things and how we can connect? And I used to use that as a way of having conversations, but the right evidence was never available to me. You know, the evidence about what are those highly successful organizations doing, it just wasn't freely available to people like me. So I thought, why not? And so I was curious and I started a small research project in the early 2000s, which to me was a pure curiosity project about why are some successful in using technology, not even defining success, and others aren't. And that grew into a 15-year study that became a global study, a community-driven study from starting in Europe, really literally going around the globe and developed maturity models. And I did that for 15 years. And then 5 years ago, I thought, I've spent a lot of time looking at this data and there's not necessarily a lot of movement. Something's got to shift. And was able to do a different type of research through the COVID period. And I'm just so curious, Rich. I am so curious about how we can be our very best selves in learning and development. And that has been my personal motivation for literally all of my career.
It's fascinating. And I love the arc of your journey. And then you mentioned something there that the sort of culmination of your research I was hearing correctly, maturation models, the things that sort of signal maturity in the learning and development space. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? It sounds fascinating. What did you find? What insights did you have there?
Well, initially, we drew, and my organization was called Towards Maturity. And the research, by the way, continues today, 20 years on, under the moniker of the Learning Performance Benchmark. And it's carried on by MindTools for Business. So I'm so thrilled that it's got deep, strong roots that are still relevant today and still is available to people. But my initial research was looking at traditional types of maturity models, you know, the novice and the experience and those that are experimenting and practice and those that were embedded. Initially we asked people those questions, but actually as the study developed, Rich, what we ended up doing, I was very passionate about not testing different models, but how do we deconstruct models like Charles Jennings and the 70-20-10 model and Kathy Moore and action learning mapping and all the different models out there into the behaviors, the core behaviors. And we also asked people questions about, what are you trying to achieve? It was always skills, productivity, time to competence, big, bold, fabulous goals that we have as an industry. And then we said, and are you achieving them? And, not so much, but we had big goals. But some were, and that was in...
Because I've been a L&D practitioner, as you may know. I was at in financial services for 10 years and then 10 years in tech at eBay and Google. I was running executive education at Google. So the stickiness and the sort of sustainability of the learning was always a question. Like, we had our laundry list of things that we wanted to entrain and help people develop against, what leaders needed, their competencies. But they always experienced what I call leadership drift. I'm not sure that that's my term. I probably borrowed it from someplace. It might have actually been Lee Hecht Harrison or Bob Lee from Hecht Harrison coined that term, but leadership drift. They just always sort of lost the thread of the core lessons, and ingraining it was always very difficult. So I could very much relate to what you're saying from those experiences. And I know probably our audience is scratching their heads too, going, why does anything stick?
Exactly. And my very first study, what I noticed was the stuff that stuck was the stuff that was completely integrated into the way that their organization worked. So it was, we're trying to improve customer service. It was definitely things that we are trying to improve revenue. Yes, there was elements of, we're going to trying to improve risk and safety, but it was real hardcore business issues that those high-performing teams right at the beginning of my study were looking at. So that's always been a theme for questions I ask, what are you trying to achieve for the business versus for learning and development? And I'm finding gradually over time, those who wanted to do it, lots of people, those who were actually felt that they were having some kind of achievement, probably about half of the ones who wanted to achieve it, those that were actually putting some numbers against it dropped right down. But over a period of 10 years, we gathered data from 200-300 people who were actually delivering really strong business value improvements in productivity, an average of 9% of improvement in retention of staff, 27% improvement. We gradually got to some strong data. So that allowed us, Rich, to be able to, instead of saying, how mature do you think you are, be able to say, okay, well, what kind of behaviors correlated back to those business results. And out of that, over a period of 15 years, came different models and ideas of what was correlating back to results. And so for me, after 15 years, I tried to break the whole thing. I said, look, this is crazy. But actually what we saw in trying to break it was that there was a very clear four stage kind of model, but as kind of a curve model that came about. So transactional learning initially, and what's lovely is this is repeated. You look at other people's models, bursting, whatever. That's a wonderful thing about data, is triangulated. That kind of first order taking transactional focus on efficiency, really good at efficiency, maybe using some basic learning management systems, some content libraries, but responding to learning. And then the next stage was very much, and in that first stage, let me just say, there were definite benefits. And that's one of the challenges we have when we're getting successful at saving money, at doing more for less. Then it actually makes us very aware that sometimes we need to let go of what's made us successful in the past in order to become more aligned to business, more connected, more engaged, more thinking about the experiences that we're developing for learning transfer, making things sticky. That's the next stage. But actually, those first two parts of the curve still only focused on learning professionals as producers, maybe producers of micro things, of experiences, but still producers. The second part of the transformation model really showed how when we shifted to becoming enablers of learning in our organization, that's when those business results that I was sharing with you start to escalate. And the high-performing teams were those that were absolutely working. And you will really get this, Rich, in collaboration, in connection, working in terms of the understanding the context, co-creating value rather than trying to prove value. Really very, very exciting to see. But even in last year's study, only 10% of 900 organizations who took part were really even touching that high performing area. So, and over 50% of us are typically in the transactional stage. So there's exciting work for us all to do, particularly in the world of AI.
Okay, so then if I'm hearing you correctly, the first two stages, sort of like the foundational stages, are that sort of transactional learning where you're kind of covering the basics, let's call it an LMS and content libraries and, competency-based training, then moving to the enablement of learning in your organization and being able to be a facilitator in some ways or a collaborator in a kind of collective learning journey. Is that correct?
Yeah. That's right. But I think it goes more than that. I think it's actually a more strategic, it's a strategic mindset that people have of actually, and I've created something that which initially was just for me to try and understand this, why is it that most of us are stuck in those earlier stages? And I created what I called the learning value spectrum. And it's not the fact that you have to move from one way to the other, but actually potentially when we see personally our value as being how to save money, how to get more engagement, when we're entering our awards program and we've got all this amazing data of how many people have completed the course and all of that kind of stuff, when we see our value as that, that's what we're looking for. But when we see our value as potentially being able to contribute back to business, then it gets messy, Rich, doesn't it? That's the place when you're working in the space of performance support, enabling community learning, encouraging the transfer of learning and skills back into the workplace, working with managers to be able to. That's where it gets messy. That's not in control then.
And that sounds like a fairly advanced stage. I mean, is that stage two of four? Is that what
that would be the final stage where we're much more cognizant of how we are working in that space. And we're willing to experiment more, to roll our sleeves up more, to try things.
Okay.
And so we start to use data not only to prove ourselves, but to improve ourselves. And that to me is this wonderful growth mindset that seems to be exuded from organizations who are more confident in working in those areas.
Right. And it sounds like also that's where you can demonstrate learning impact, which I know is something that you're very much interested in and focused on. And in some ways, that's a central thing for L&D practitioners in terms of getting company support and financing for learning, which can be challenging. I'm sure it's a challenge many of our listeners face. And so when we think about impact and positioning, kind of learning approaches, learning initiatives, how would you recommend someone go about getting buy-in for, their new learning initiatives, programs, what have you, especially with the idea of impact in mind?
Well, I think you have to be a curious person working in learning and development, and we have to understand what impact looks like for those that we're trying to engage rather than what impact looks like for us. So for us to be, we've been given a job, maybe to do courses, to do curriculum, to run a learning management system, to explore all of these things, and that's our job. But actually, if we want buy-in, we have to say, actually, this my job, what's the why of my job? Why am I here? What is my role in this organization, this not-for-profit organization, this public sector organization, this finance organization? And what is it that I really need to do to contribute value back into the organization? So if we want to get buy-in for an idea, we have to buy in to business before we can get business to buy in to us. And I think that's the trick that we miss. If any of your learning and development listeners are used to working with salespeople or selling a new tool, what they'll notice is that the salesperson, if they're good, will actually be listening to their needs first and then mapping to their needs in order to get buy-in for a new tool and solution. And that's exactly the same thing that we need to do back into the organization, because we can't sell the features of a new system without being really clear of what the unique benefits are back to the business. And I think it's a simple sales trick, but it's something that we just don't do. I think only 50% of us analyze a business problem before recommending a solution. It's slightly over 50% now. And then if we need it, really want it to make impact, we've also got to deliver that solution in a timely way. These are the things that I think are the heart. When we strip everything back, that's where people have a problem with buy-in, because we've bought something that supports learning, but we can't articulate how that goes on to support business. So we have to kind of go back to basics.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a false distinction or binary that exists, that learning isn't also a part of the evolution of the business and isn't a sort of part and parcel of what a good business practice is. So a good learning practice is also a good business practice. But it's very easy to lose sight of that, I think, because they seem to sometimes be so distinct. I'll give you an example from our own world, right? We do a lot of emotional intelligence and neuroscience-based kind of mindset, mindfulness, like all these different kinds of trainings. And people think, oh, well, that's a very nice to have, but not a need to have, because what I really need is some like business tools. But what they don't realize is that the two are actually one and the same, right? Because if collaboration is important to you, if communication is important to you, if conflict management is important for you, if adaptability, innovation, creativity, resilience is important to you, well, the only way you're going to get there is to go down to that foundational level and work at the level of the human foundation, our minds and our capacities, and work to enhance those. And so to me, those are not divisible. So when we talk about emotional intelligence training, people are like, that's soft skills. I actually say, no, that's not soft skills. Those are core skills, right? Those aren't soft skills. They're core skills, because they're core to what it means to operate effectively as a business leader, as a leader in any organization, actually business or nonprofit, whatever sector you're in. If you work with other people, because the great irony is I used to work at Google, and emotional intelligence training was hugely, a search inside yourself was developed at Google, the organization I run today, because Literally, some of the engineers didn't realize working with other humans was in the job description.
Yeah.
So we had to like say, no, it is, and you can train the skills for it, and it will allow you to be a better engineer. And it certainly did, because they could work Agile or Scrums or whatever they were involved in a much more effective way. So they're not divisible, these things.
Absolutely.
So that being said, Laura, I know you've been focusing a lot on that as well, right? You've been focusing in terms of L&D innovation. You've been focusing a lot on the inner game, I think is how you like to describe it. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's basically, you know, over that 15 years of doing the research study into what correlates back to better business impact, we shared so many insights. And, you know, since then, over that 15-year period, people have written so many books about it. You know, we know a lot of stuff in L&D now. We attend conferences, we listen to podcasts, we know about learning transfer, we know about technology, we're learning more about the brain, and yet we're not doing it. Which was really interesting. So during the pandemic period, I had this amazing opportunity to work with two colleagues, one Shannon Tipton in Chicago and Michelle Ockers in Australia, to explore the question, you know, how can we emerge stronger from a pandemic? Now, nobody has been in a pandemic before. No L&D professional had been in a pandemic. And we did a series of podcast interviews. But as we were doing these podcast interviews, I was talking to people, and they were exhibiting some of the qualities that we just described about the high-performance team. But the other thing that really struck me was their attitude, Rich, to the challenges ahead and how they were coping with their attitudes. And I kind of revisited my work with that lens of, you know, how do our thinking habits actually influence the decisions that we make and the way that we respond to difficult and disruptive situations. And it was just fascinating to me when I sort of started to analyze the podcast to see actually those that seem to be riding the wave okay of disruption, even being put on furlough, were those who had already were quite adaptive, and it made me realize that there were different thinking habits that we have. And so for me, a professional thinking habit is the kind of fixed attitude and tendency that we might have that would influence the decisions that we make about our professional world of work. So I don't dig into the kind of the stuff that you do, the important stuff, but really looking at the L&D professional thinking habits. How do we think about value? We've talked about that. Do we see ourselves as driving value through learning or through adding value back to business? Because how we see our value will influence the decisions that we make and how we try and sell our services back and how we try and prove our services. But I also think about, you know, how do we see our role? You know, do we see ourselves as being needing to be that knowledgeable expert? I'm the training expert and I know how to do training and listen to me. Or do we see ourselves more as an empathetic explorer and say, actually, my job is to really understand what you need so that I can bring my expertise and layer upon that. I see, you know, how do we see our role will influence how we interact? Yeah, how do we see our relationship with others? Do we see ourselves as being needing to be very independent, needing to prove ourselves, or that we're interdependent? And looking ways of co-creating value back into the business. You see, these are the sorts of thinking habits that I think really do influence how we approach the challenges that we see in front of us. And I don't think one is right or one is wrong, but I think we need to become, and I think you guys talk about this, a lot more self-aware about where we're coming from, because our habits get formed when things have been celebrated in the past, when we're asked to do things, when we're given a pat on the back because we've responded in a particular way. You know, these habits get ingrained, but sometimes we need to understand where to challenge the status quo internally in order to challenge the status quo of our industry, in order to say, actually, I know we've always had this leadership program, but what if? I've got some data here, 27% of improvement in productivity overall. What if we only got 3% of that by doing something different? Is it worth us trying? You know, it's that you need an attitude inside of you to be able to harness some of the data that people like myself and others around the globe are presenting back into the industry? Yeah,
absolutely. I think, I'm a systems thinker in general. So when I think about L&D and systems, you know, like there's a lot of pressure on L&D practitioners to kind of like be essentially kind of like a functionary and just kind of do what you're asked and kind of business as usual, and maybe a little bit less of a pull for being a disruptor. Or if you're being a disruptor, like, you know, prove it to me first. And that's reasonable, I think, in businesses, but I think it is striking that right balance, knowing when you're just kind of carrying out, like you said, like the standard or habitual way of practicing, as opposed to taking that opportunity to disrupt. And, yeah, you know, one of the things that I know you have been working on since 2020, at least, is something you call learning change makers, which I think is really interesting, probably continuing along the lines of this conversation. But learning change makers, can you tell us a little about what that is and what its mission is and what you're currently working on there?
Well, when I stopped working with the Towards Maturity study, it was, you know, sometimes, you know, I talk a lot to L&D people about sometimes you got to let go before you can move on. And that was an experience for me that I had to do that. I had to let go of this data and this maturity model if I really wanted to dig in deeper into supporting the learning and development community today. And during that kind of liminal space, it was a really good opportunity for me to look in and search inside myself to find out what was I really passionate about with the industry, because I still love this industry so much. But actually, I was passionate about the small opportunities that we can find to make a difference. And I was really taken with the idea of change makers from the Ashoka Change Makers, a social entrepreneurship movement. You know, where they're training up young people and disadvantaged people to say, look, if you see this needed in your community, you small child in your park, you see litter, this is the kind of core skills, human skills that you are going to need in order for you to make a difference in your park, in your community. And I just thought, Rich, you know, if young kids, if women in impoverished places around the world can rise up and make a difference in their communities, then as learning professionals, we can do the same. And I have all of this experience, all of this data to say, look, it's possible. So learning change makers for me felt like a natural umbrella for pulling together collaborative research, insight, stories. You know, the work that I do mainly is still research work, but it's much more collaborative with individual organizations. I do sounding board work, you know, because it's not I want to become a consultant to other people, but I want them to release the potential from within themselves to be these radical difference. And this was before generative AI. And even now, I'm more convinced even now how exciting an opportunity we have as learning professionals to own our future, to shape our future, not to be shaped by our circumstances. And so it's an aspirational desire of mine for the industry after 30 years being here. I still believe, and I still want the very best for people.
I love that. Well, that's, I think, the core of why we all get into this, right? You started with discussing like human potential, and I think that's really what we are all passionate about, and whether it's our own journeys or, you know, facilitating that for others. So maybe as by way of ending, is there any last sort of encouragements or sort of words of wisdom? You've been in this industry for a while, you've studied it deeply. You know, if we're now listening, folks who are listening are learning and development practitioners or teachers or educators or anyone who's interested in helping foster human potential and growth. Any last reflections to share with them?
I hadn't thought about sharing in this way, but I think I will. One of the things that has really been clear to me is that we need courage to be able to shape the future, to be the kind of real support system for those who need to be able to continually learn, continually adapt. But that takes a level of courage. And So for me, boldness is really important. And I don't talk about that brassy, that shoot from the hip bold, like, oh, you know, I'm a maverick, I'm going to just tear everything down, you know, because most of us aren't like that. We're careful, considered, but for me, it's about us being smart, bold. And that for me means that we have a focus on what's important to the organization we're working in. So I say business first. You know, you are here to serve our organization today. Whatever that means, let's get close to that. Business first. Open-minded. The fact that we should be able to learn from evidence, learn from benchmarks, but don't feel you have to repeat them. You're open-minded to other ideas, bring the outside in, open-minded to other ideas within the organization. Very important. Connection, collaboration, open-mindedness. L for leading and learning. The fact that we're actually willing to do even small experiments and learn from them, tiny things, big things, but we're willing to step out. So that kind of boldness is leading. But D is for deliberate. It's about being intentional. It's about being purposeful. It's about looking at risk, using evidence, managing risk. So bold, smart bold, I think is what we need in the industry right now.
Well, thank you. I couldn't agree more. And I think that's probably for the foreseeable future, what's going to be needed, given how complex and challenging and demanding, you know, the world that we all operate in is. And the things that our organizations are trying to do and the disruptions that are just coming at a faster rate and pace. So thank you so much for sharing, you know, your wisdom and your insights. It's funny, we haven't met, by the way, and I know you're in England, I'm sitting here in San Francisco, and I feel like we could be having coffee either there or here and can continue this conversation for hours. So hopefully we have more opportunities, but it's just such a pleasure to start the conversation with you, to share with our audience some of these insights. And thank you for your time, and thanks everybody for tuning in today. Thank you, Laura. Appreciate you.
It's been fantastic. And yes, let's say yes to that coffee.